Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. If you hear a little bit of a change in my voice, I've been suffering from a cold the last few days. I think I'm right at the tail end, but bear with me if you notice a difference. I can certainly hear it. So before I begin, I want to mention a few of my new patrons on Patreon.com that have generously begun supporting me on the NewsHound level. And with that great help comes a shout-out on the show. First, a big thank you to Emma from Nairobi, Kenya. She is a big fan of Ellen Poulsen, especially, who, by the way, will be a three-peat guest in the near future. John has also recently joined the fold, listening from the beautiful and frigid Greeker, Norway. I was lucky enough to find myself in Norway last year and enjoyed the scenery and the hospitality tremendously. Appreciate it so much, John. And I can't forget Harry tuning in from picturesque Vail, Arizona, known for the nearby colossal Cave Mountain Park. You are a champion, sir. I have more shout-outs coming next week. Oh, and if you are interested in more information about how you can help through Patreon, go to patreon.com/mostnotorious, and let's get on to the show. So glad to have as my guest today, Leif Pedersen. He is a freelance writer, humorist, tourism professional, and travel journalist who has written extensively for the Lonely Planet Travel Guides. He is also the author of Backpacking with Dracula, On the Trail of Vlad the Impaler Dracula and the Vampire He Inspired. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So where did your fascination with Dracula first come from?
Well, I was actually living in Romania. I'd never even read the Dracula novel, and I only had, like most people, I only had like passing knowledge that Dracula was a real life person back in the 15th century. And, you know, what you do read, if you just read the top level stuff, he was a sadist and crazy and kind of a jerk. But, you know, living in Romania and then subsequently researching multiple editions of The Lonely Planet Guide to Romania, I got deeper into the history. There's a lot of surviving sites in Romania that are associated with Dracula because, you know, this is Europe and things are centuries old everywhere you look. So as I got deeper and deeper into that and visited the sites associated with him more and more, I just started doing a little more digging. I finally read the novel. And then, you know, I just thought after I ended up spending a cumulative 2 years in Romania and I had this topic that I was getting deeper into, I thought, well, it's about time life to write your first travel memoir, and so here I am. And then it kind of morphed into more history than travel memoir, but nonetheless, here we are.
So I'd like to start by asking you about the geography of the area. Romania, Transylvania, I'd love it if you could explain where they are and how these areas were especially important in the 15th century, which is where our story takes place.
Sure. Well, so Romania, it's on the eastern side of Eastern Europe. So, you know, it touches the Black Sea, and its neighbors are Bulgaria to the south and Ukraine to the north, and Moldova sort of to the northeast, and to the west is Hungary. So, yeah, in the 15th century, there was no Romania, of course. It was just a bunch of kingdoms and principalities and things like that. So the real Dracula, the Vlad the Impaler, wasn't actually from Transylvania. He was Prince of Wallachia, which is a principality at the time that was south of Transylvania. Dracula spent plenty of time in Transylvania, but he was the Prince of Wallachia, and that was his stomping grounds and the area that he was desperately trying to defend against some very powerful neighbors. At the time, Wallachia was like a little tiny grape in the middle of a tug of war between two, you know, giant dogs. There was the Ottoman Empire to the south and to the east, and they were, you know, they had just conquered Constantinople. They were at the height of their power and terrifying. And, you know, little Wallachia is just right there. After they rolled over Bulgaria, Wallachia was definitely feeling the stress. And then to the northwest was the Kingdom of Hungary. And then also the Roman Empire beyond that. And of course, Christian Europe. But, you know, in the 15th century, Wallachia was kind of a, I guess, by Christian Europe standards, it was just, you know, this little hillbilly backwater part of Europe, you know, and they were vaguely aware of things. They were, you know, obviously aware that the Ottoman Empire was growing in strength and had pretty specific plans to roll into Christian Europe and absorb all that. But a little place like Wallachia was not on very many people's radar at the time, but very quickly they became so because, like I said, they were right on the doorstep of Christian Europe, and the Ottoman Empire was standing on the doorstep and getting ready to stomp all over them on their way into Transylvania and then off continuing into the Kingdom of Hungary. So, you know, while Wallachia was kind of on its own over in this corner, toe-to-toe with one of the largest military forces in Europe at the time, they didn't have a whole lot of support because it was just, you know, it's kind of like us thinking about Guam right now. It's just like so far away, and there was things more important that were happening right in everybody's own little yard. And so in the beginning in particular, Wallachia had a little trouble getting other folks riled up and understanding the urgency of what Ottoman Empire, you know, rolling over them and going into Transylvania, what the ramifications for that for all of Europe meant. So they were in a very tough spot, to put it lightly, and they didn't have a whole lot of choice about the matter. They had to sign an agreement of partnership with the Ottoman Empire because it was either that or get annihilated. So they, in the beginning, Dracula and his father and grandfather before them, they had these arrangements with the Ottoman Empire where they would be autonomous, but they were effectively, you know, an Ottoman in distant territory, and they, you know, they had to pay annual dues to the Ottoman Empire, and for a while there they were shipping off all of their young strong men to be absorbed into their military. So before Dracula came along, they were definitely under the heel, and then for a time after, while Dracula was getting his act together, still under the heel, and then Dracula was the first real resistance to the Ottoman Empire on behalf of all of Christian Europe, so he, which is why he was suddenly thrust into the limelight.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. Vlad Dracula, he got dragged into all of this as a kid. He had a far busier childhood than any of us could ever imagine experiencing.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's hard to parse history from 500 years ago, especially when it's told by so many different people with so many different biases. But the generally agreed upon theory is that Dracula was a normal kid and turned into a inconsolable, sullen teenager and then a psychopath because he spent most of that time as a, let's say, a guest of the Ottoman Empire. It was kind of a study abroad slash hostage situation that he was caught into. His father, Vlad Dracul II. So first of all, there's that confusion right there. His father was Vlad Dracul, and then we have Vlad Dracula III. So the name mix-ups were constant for me while I was researching this book and writing the book. But his father, Vlad Dracul, as part of one of many agreements with the Ottoman Empire, he signed that the agreements re-upping their allegiance to the Ottomans. And since the Sultan wasn't entirely sure that Vlad Dracul was going to stay loyal, he decided to take Vlad's two oldest sons, so that's Vlad Dracula and Radu, and he kept them in his court. And, you know, they were sort of prisoners, but they were treated very well. You know, they got a normal, very high-level education appropriate for royalty. And so they learned history and philosophy. You know, they had Greek scholars as teachers. They learned horsemanship and fighting and weapons and, you know, just the kind of the not necessarily what we would have gotten in our high school days, but what was common for children of a certain stature to be taught as they were growing up, sort of in a way being, you know, prepared for their future as leader of something. But equally, he was a kind of he wasn't super thrilled about his arrangements there, and he was rebellious, and so he was punished a lot. And in the 15th century, punishment was almost always physical, although I'm sure there was plenty of psychological torture as well. And I think just being away from home for so long in an unfamiliar location, where especially in the beginning they didn't understand what people were saying around them, and the threat constantly of them being punished for something that their father might do, you know, way far away in Wallachia, was a stressful time for them. And, you know, Radu sort of rolled with the punches, and he was fortunate in that he was handsome and friendly and everybody liked him, but Dracula was neither of those things. And so he definitely suffered extravagantly, and that's the overriding theory of how he went from normal kid to psychopath.
So the Sultan, in having these two boys as hostages, was really able to leverage things into his favor. Their father was pretty desperate to get them back, or at least not have them killed, and was willing to make a lot of concessions.
Exactly. And, you know, Vlad had a lot to lose. I mean, his sons being hostages was only just a part of that. You know, his kingdom that he'd fought so hard to maintain and hold, because of there were so many challenges to his rule over time. And funny little side note that princes at the time, princes of Wallachia, their average reign was only 2 years. I mean, these guys were coming and going. It was hot, and the musical chairs was just happening left and right, because there was, as soon as someone got installed and started doing something that the you know, the elite class and the trading class didn't like, they would work to undermine them and get them unseated and install the next guy until that guy displeased them, you know. So Vlad had trouble at home with internal provocateurs. He had trouble trying to make everyone happy and not get annihilated with the Ottomans on one side and Hungary on the other side. And then, of course, yeah, his two eldest sons were a couple hundred miles away under the watchful eye of a not very friendly sultan.
It was interesting reading how he and his brother, how their paths diverged so drastically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, to put it kindly, Radu was, like I said, handsome and friendly, and he scored many points as a brown noser while he was a guest of the court, and Dracula was not. He was unhappy. He was pissed off, to be perfectly frank. And so between Radu being everybody's favorite and just Vlad being angrier and angrier and rebelling more and more, he was just isolated him completely. And pretty, you know, he didn't even have his brother after a while as to commiserate with. It was just him by himself being held captive with the, you know, the threat of being blinded or killed if the Sultan ever had a bad day with his father.
And this would be the 1450s, right?
Yes.
And things really put him over the edge, didn't they, when both his father and another of his brothers were killed, right?
Yeah, so in reference to my previous statement about internal provocateurs inside Wallachia, Vlad had displeased some of the elite class, and they worked very hard to run them out of town. And when that didn't work, they allowed the Sultan's men to come in. They just basically opened the gate and said, here, have at it. So his father was killed, and Mircea, his older brother, was buried alive, which was not uncommon in those days. And, you know, little Vlad, even though they'd been separated for several years, he loved his older brother very much. And, you know, I think he was having some trouble with his relationship with his father. But I think, you know, just that aside, just knowing that a bunch of people conspired and had his father and brother killed, that was just like, that was it. He went like supernova angry, and there was no turning back.
All of this stuff is complicated. Constant backstabbing, murder, battles, rape. It seems like Wallachia is being ruled by someone different on every page of your book. How, amongst all of this chaos, does Vlad Dracula take power? How does he do it?
So after the Ottomans killed his father and brother, Dracula, he was still in the Ottoman Empire, and although he was kind of a unpleasant guest, he was still kind of, he was trusted by them. Ultimately, at the end of the day, they saw him as an ally, even though he was an unwilling ally. And so the person that took the throne after his father and brother were killed, over time, sort of, well, I shouldn't say over time, it was probably like a year, but that person lost favor with the Sultan. And Dracula had made an offer to the Sultan that if the Sultan would give him enough military support, he would go in and take the throne back from that guy whose name escapes me. Like you are right, there was a different prince every couple of years there, and I've already forgotten who came next. But yes, with the support of the Ottoman Empire, believe it or not, Vlad galloped into Wallachia and took the throne from this guy. And he installed himself on the throne. And the Sultan at first was like, okay, this is great. We got a friend of the court on the seat finally in Wallachia, and getting this invasion ready for Christian Europe should be pretty straightforward.
Could you describe what Vlad looked like?
Yeah. Many years later, he spent some time in jail, and he had already a reputation for being just ferocious and terrifying. But, you know, in jail, he was kind of, his wings were clipped. And so historians and portraitists started showing up, and that's how we know what he looked like. By those reports, he was short and stout, extremely strong. He had a beak nose and these bulging green eyes and puffy, oversized eyebrows. He just, just looked terrifying. You know, he had resting terrifying face, and that was part of his whole aura. Anyone that didn't even know his reputation, you walk in the room and you see this guy, you're like, oh, I'm just going to give this guy a wide berth.
So he's got all this pent-up rage, all of this hostility, seen a lot of terrible things in his life. Once he took power, how did he hold on to it?
So he didn't. he was actually on the throne in three separate sittings. His first sitting, right after grabbing the throne, ostensibly on behalf of the Ottoman Empire, that only lasted a few months because he immediately got into trouble with the Ottoman Empire and other folks in Wallachia who were not pleased to have Vlad Dracul's angry and vengeful son back in the picture. So, yeah, there was a bit of time where he held onto that power, and he used that time to do a little house cleaning, and by that I mean killing of people that had anything to do with his father and brother's death. But then he immediately had to flee again because he was quickly unpopular at home, and the Ottomans were getting a little testy and impatient with who they thought the guy that was going to be their guy was not initially being super cooperative, and he had to flee. And so he fled to a region up north called Moldavia, which is still goes by that name in this day. It's a part of Romania, and he had some relatives up there, namely the person who would later become Stephen the Great. And he hid out there for a while. He finished his education. He somehow resisted the urge to turn around and go killing people immediately. He hung around, finished his education, you know, became a man or whatever, and yeah. So his first sitting was very short. It was the second sitting where all of the fun happened.
Yeah, let's talk about that fun. He develops a reputation for cruelty, which is pretty incredible, since everyone else in this time and place also seemed very cruel. What sets his cruelty apart from everyone else's?
Well, and that's an important, you make an important point, because he was extremely cruel and sadistic and a jerk. But for that era, he was only slightly more sadistic than average when you look at what other people were doing in terms of torture and, you know, military tactics. In political circles, it was not uncommon for, if you were someone was giving you trouble, you'd go in and you just wipe out their whole family, because it wasn't enough just to kill them, because a cousin or a sibling or one of their children might show up someday with a mind of revenge. And so it was the easiest way to avoid that inconvenience was just to kill everybody. And that was just normal. I mean, that wasn't Wallachia or Eastern Europe. That was happening everywhere. You know, they were crucifying people before that. Even there was the Spanish Inquisition was unbelievably sadistic. So we just want to set the scene here that Dracula was just fantastically terrifying and brutal. But compared to those around him, he was only slightly worse. But After finishing his education and getting some support from the Kingdom of Hungary, because they were also not super thrilled about having the Ottoman Empire so close with a friendly face on the throne in Wallachia, he turned around and with some help managed to take his throne back. And this time he hung on to it for just under 6 years, I want to say. And this was the period where he really did all of the damage that he's known for today. He fortified his princely seat in Targoviste, which is where the capital of Wallachia was. He built a couple of other forts. He was basically just fortifying the whole area because he knew he was about to incur the white hot wrath of the Ottoman Empire. And he wasn't exactly on tight terms with the Hungarians either. So he was just kind of, he spent the time cleaning house, killing a lot more people that had offended him or irritated him in some way, but also fortifying his kingdom for the upcoming battle with the Ottomans. And in theory, he should have had some help. You know, again, the Ottomans were not making a secret of their plan to roll over Wallachia, Transylvania, and then just keep right on going into Christian Europe and, you know, I guess all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. So you would think that other players in Europe would have kind of been on the same page and said, yeah, we gotta take care of this. It's time to mount a crusade. And they did do that previously, but when it came time for Dracula to stand up against the Ottoman Empire, he had no help, because everybody else in Europe, either they were indifferent or they had other stuff going on, pressing stuff. You know, there were people having their own little wars and civil wars and border skirmishes, and maybe like the Spanish, they had just booted out the Moors. Everyone had their own thing going on, and despite the overwhelming forces of the Ottoman Empire getting all geared up to come and take them, they sent no help. So it was poor Vlad all on his own. But he did have the Wallachians, and he did have some money, and he hired some mercenaries and got some military forces together in addition to, you know, his subjects. And they got themselves ready to take on the Ottomans.
So in taking on the Ottomans, he was going to take the fight to them.
Yeah, well, that's initially what happened, because, you know, even at the height of their power, the Wallachians only had about 30,000 people in their military. Some of them were mercenaries, some of them were paid and actual brawlers, but a lot of them were just farmers and other, you know, peasants that they just, you know, they shoved a sword in their hand and, you know, gave them a helmet and shoved them in the general direction of the fight. So it's not really fair to say that he had 30,000 troops. But and then meanwhile, the Ottoman Empire had 90,000 real life armed and fierce and trained fighters. So Dracula was crazy, but he wasn't so crazy as to think he could go toe to toe with these folks. So he started some really what ultimately became unbelievably effective guerrilla warfare against the Ottomans. They were still on the Bulgarian side of the Danube River. The Danube separates Bulgaria from Romania, or Wallachia at the time. And so they crossed the river and they just started taking them out in little groups. They would ambush them. They would come galloping down a side road, kill a whole bunch of guys, and then run away before the Ottomans could muster a counterattack. And they just kind of did that until it over time just started to actually wear away at the Ottoman military might. And Christian Europe, it was just unbelievable that it was just the underdog story of their lives that Dracula was having this success. But while he was doing this, he was also perfecting his favorite hobby and what he's known for, impaling people. So this is where the whole legend comes from, Vlad the Impaler. He wasn't known as Vlad the Impaler as when he was alive, but that's the name they gave him after his death. So he, if he had the time and the wherewithal, he would take the slain Ottomans and impale them. And the way it was done in those days, what they did was I suppose I should say this is a warning to people who have squeamish stomachs, maybe just skip ahead a minute. But what they would do is they'd get a wooden stake, pretty thick one. They would grease it up, and then they would insert it ever so slowly into the victim's anus and just kind of slowly guide it up through their body so as not to hit any internal organs, but also unbelievably painful. And it would emerge from their bodies just, you know, below their shoulder blades. So they are upright on a pike that is in the ground, and they're just upright, and it doesn't kill them right away. They just suffer that way. And, you know, they could suffer for up to a couple of days before they actually died. It was the most sadistic, vicious thing. And Vlad didn't even invent it, but he certainly perfected it. And this is how he became famous, partly because of all the impalings. And later on, kind of a coup de grace of impaling when the Ottomans finally got to Targoviste. I'm getting ahead of myself, but Vlad had a little surprise waiting for them.
Before we get to that, because I don't want to forget, what are the origins of the name Dracula?
Dracula means son of Dracul, and Dracul was the name that his father was given when he was inducted into the Knights Templar. And, you know, he converted from his Orthodox to Christian, and he was given the name Dracul, which means dragon. Although many centuries later, Bram Stoker decided to sort of reclassify that as devil. But anyway, so Dracula is son of the dragon.
So yeah, I would love to hear that story about how he prepared for the oncoming onslaught of the Ottoman Empire.
So again, Dracula, despite lots of success, taking out people in guerrilla warfare tactics, one final attempt by the Sultan. The Sultan, for a minute, just a minute, thought, okay, this guy is giving me a lot of trouble. Let's just see if we can't calm things down. He sent an envoy to make an arrangement for some sort of ceasefire, but it was duplicitous, and Vlad found out that they actually intended to grab him and haul him back to Constantinople and punish him for all the trouble he's caused. So instead of talking with that peace envoy, he slaughtered them all and, of course, impaled them. So when that got back to the Sultan, that was pretty much it. They had been at odds for a while, but there was just like no turning back. Dracula was persona non grata. They were going to take him, and he had actually succeeded in pissing off the Sultan so much that he was going to personally lead this unheard of armada of Ottomans and just roll over Wallachia and take it on their way into Transylvania and presumably, you know, fillet Dracula like a carp on the way.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
So we're still in his second reign here, right? That 6-year period.
Correct. Yeah, when it became clear that Dracula was going to have to face this military tsunami that was coming at him, he still knew, I mean, there was no way that they were going to go toe-to-toe. They were going to get annihilated. So he had no other choice but to just kind of like continue on with the guerrilla tactics. And again, it was extremely effective. They were losing plenty of folks, but Dracula had some really big victories against these overwhelming forces. And part of it was that they knew the terrain much better than the Ottomans, but also growing up in the Sultan's court, Dracula had become fluent in Turkish, and he knew the Sultan, and he knew, you know, how he thought, he knew his tactics. He, you know, he was just like the inside man there. And all of a sudden this guy's coming at him, and Dracula knows all his tricks. So he did a lot of counterattacks that wore them down. There was a one famous attack called the Night Attack, where Dracula dressed up as an Ottoman soldier and was able to get into the camp because he spoke Turkish fluently, and went around and did some recon and came out and got all his force together, and they just charged in and were very successful in taking out a whole bunch of guys, and Vlad almost killed the Sultan himself. But he got a little confused in the dark and attacked the wrong tent, and the Sultan got away. But it was extremely successful, and again, a huge blow to the Sultan's men. But they were not cowed at all. They continued on their way to Targoviste, which is where the princely court is, Wallachia's princely court. And so Dracula had no choice but to retreat at this stage because they were wildly outmatched. And so, not wanting to just run away and do nothing, he made life absolutely miserable for the Turks. That summer was a particularly hot summer, so it was already uncomfortable, but Vlad and his people, they would poison water sources, they would burn down forests, they would either slaughter or herd away cattle. There was just nothing for the Ottomans to, you know, there was no shade even sometimes. The Ottomans were just constantly hot and thirsty, and they were weakened by all the, you know, they weren't eating well. And there was just, you have to imagine 90,000 people and the support crew that goes with that. There was just so many mouths to feed and so many resources necessary. And Vlad was making all of that very difficult. But, you know, they marched on, and every once in a while, a group of Wallachians would jump out, kill a whole bunch of people again, and just leave. And this just kind of went like that. And also, one of the earliest known uses of germ warfare, Vlad got a whole bunch of people suffering from various diseases, including the plague, dressed them up as Turks, and just sent them in to mingle with the Ottomans. And they just got a whole bunch of people sick and died. And they, you know, that was without firing a single arrow. It was just brilliant and cruel. And so these guys were just stumbling along now, sick, thirsty, hot. They got real close to Targoviste, but before they got there, one of the final things that Vlad did was he'd been judiciously and happily impaling people all along, thousands and thousands of these Ottomans that they'd been sneak attacking in one way or another. So after a while, he had quite the collection of dead Ottomans on wooden pikes. So what he did was he and his men erected what was described as a semicircle and quote-unquote forest of impaled Ottomans, about 30,000 of them. So you can imagine Mehmed the Sultan, he's called Mehmed the Conqueror. He's marching up with the shadow of the former might of his military, but they're still determined to get to Targoviste. They're walking up, their spirits are kind of snuffed out, they're not feeling great, and they see this forest of 30,000 dead bodies of their former comrades right in front of them, and it literally scared them away. Like Mehmed himself, who was a well-known master of psychological warfare, he was just like, no, I'm done. And he turned around and went back to Constantinople. But they left enough military behind that Vlad couldn't just stay in Wallachia. So he had to retreat to the mountains. And the Ottomans were successful in taking the throne away from him. And that was the end of his second reign. And they installed another person on that throne. And guess who it was? It was Radu, his younger brother that they brought along. Radu and the Sultan had become friends over the years, despite some very complicated relationship. And so now Radu was the guy on the throne while Dracula was in full retreat.
Yeah, that is very complicated. There must have been some resentment from Vlad towards his brother for cozying up to his enemy.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't able to find any details about their relationship later in life. I'm assuming there was none because they were, after the first time Vlad left the Ottoman court as a teenager, the first time to take his throne back, I couldn't find any record that the two of them were even ever again in the same room before Radu, many years later, died. I believe it was syphilis.
Wow. So how does he get back on the throne for the third time?
So that didn't happen for a while. In fact, it was more than 12 years before Vlad got his throne back. He partnered up with the Hungarian Empire, and it's a very long and complicated story with a lot of characters and a lot of, again, backstabbing and planning. So Vlad eventually was taken prisoner by the Hungarians, and they trumped up some charges because Vlad this whole time he'd become a standout hero in the eyes of Christian Europe. He was single-handedly holding off the Ottoman Empire, and so people knew his name now. He was a living legend, and everybody was like, popping champagne. And then next thing they know, he's in jail in Budapest. Well, it was called Buda at the time, and so everyone was confused as to what had happened, and was just that they'd had trumped up charges. They forged some letters that were supposedly from Vlad, suggesting that he and the Sultan were somehow in cahoots, even though Vlad had just finished killing tens of thousands of his soldiers. So it was an unbelievable story, but even in the modern era, it's possible for some very sketchy, details to, eventually just become understood as, well, that just happened, let's move on. And that's kind of what happened then. People were very concerned and asked a lot of questions for a while, and then it was just kind of forgotten about, and Vlad ended up cooling his heels in very fine surroundings, but nonetheless a prisoner for 12 years in Hungary.
And in the midst of all of this, there was a man from Hungary named John Hunyadi who played a pretty important role in this giant drama.
Yeah. you're right. He was the instigator. I'm trying to keep the details to a minimum because there's so much going on. But yes, he was the one that at first was teamed up with Vlad, and they were going to finally take out the Ottomans. And then they made a secret deal on the side with the Ottomans, and then decided to stitch up Vlad and at the same time. And so, yeah, John Hunyadi and the was pretty much single-handedly responsible for betraying Vlad and locking him up. And meanwhile, they had for this final push against the Ottomans, they had actually taken quite a bit of money from supporters like the Pope and Venice and some other folks that were closer to being in the danger zone than other people in Western Europe. They'd given John a lot of money to carry on his crusade, and then the crusade just kind of never happened, and then all of a sudden Vlad was a prisoner. So John, you know, he had his own political issues to deal with, but meanwhile he was successful in taking Vlad off the board and installing yet another brother-in-law. There was never-ending sea of brother-in-laws because of the polygamy of the time. So every time someone lost a seat or got chased out, there was always a brother-in-law somehow related by blood, and that was all that was necessary. You just had to be related by blood from the male heir and to take the throne. So there was no shortage of people, and they installed their own guy for a while until that guy became uncooperative. But in the meantime, you know, Vlad was off the board for 12 whole years, and the Ottomans had plenty of time to recover and restore their might after Vlad had single-handedly worn them down to a shadow of their former selves.
Yeah, I completely understand the inherent difficulty of turning this story into a narrative. I know I've said this before on the show, but most of the stories I cover here have a similar arc in the sense that there's a murder or multiple murders, an investigation, an arrest, a trial. But here it's confusing. I mean, history over a large period of time with lots of political machinations driving things.
Even I can't keep it straight. I mean, I would have to read directly from the book in order to, you know, to make sure I'm not giving it, you know, the wrong name and the wrong chronology. But also, I was going from numerous different sources of information, and not a lot of them agreed with each other. So I kind of had to do, you know, some best guessing of, you know, piecing things together. And when I was completely confused, I just have to say that in the book. It's like, look, here are the three things that might have happened. We don't know. You know, I mean, this is what happens when you try to research something in the 15th century when a lot of people, most of them not super thrilled with Vlad and his tactics, were writing the history books.
You said that a lot of people were very happy and believed that Vlad Dracula was almost single-handedly keeping the Turkish hordes from enveloping the rest of Europe. And then he's suddenly imprisoned. Do you have a suspicion as to why? Politically motivated, I assume?
Well, yeah. You know, John Hunyadi was... He didn't want anything to do with this campaign against the Ottomans. He had his sights set on becoming the Holy Roman Emperor, and in the meantime, the King of Hungary. And he was acting King of Hungary, or whatever you would call it at the time. He in everything but crown, he was ruling it over. But he wanted to lock that down, right? And then being sent away on this crusade, you know, he had been given plenty of money to do this, and there was, you know, some tactical sense to it, but he didn't want to be in Wallachia fighting Ottomans. He wanted to consolidate power and you know, finally take the throne. So he already didn't want to be there. But then on top of that, the Ottomans just kind of made a back room deal with him that he couldn't refuse, that allowed him to, he wouldn't have to fight. He could go back home, you know, get the throne like he planned, and get Vlad out of the picture all in one stroke. So that's what he did.
Even being imprisoned for 12 years, the Ottomans didn't push any further into Europe?
Well, eventually they pulled themselves together and they were able, and which is why Vlad reenters the picture. The Ottomans had their guy on the throne in Wallachia. There was a lot of skirmishes and raids into Transylvania. So, you know, the Ottomans were just kind of creeping closer and closer and testing the waters. And finally, 12 years later, John was like, we got to deal with this. So that's when Vlad and him unbelievably came to an agreement. Vlad heroically resisted the urge to just impale John in many creative ways, and instead, because he still wanted to get back to his kingdom, and you know, he was, everything about him was getting to Wallachia, his homeland, and cleaning it up, and then ruling over, you know, as a king, but, or prince, sorry. So yes, he was able to swallow his anger and team up with John after so much bad blood, and the two of them, they went on a little PR campaign, and they somehow managed to get more money out of Italy, well, what was, you know, Italy, Rome and Venice, I should say, and they geared up for a new crusade to kick the Ottomans out once and for all, and then also in the process, Vlad would get his throne back.
Was it easy to push them back?
At first, they did have some success. They had some immediate wins. They managed to get a very important strategic defensive fort in Serbia, and do some other successful raids. And after Dracula was kind of on a trial period, you know, he was on probation sort of. So he wasn't out doing this alone. He had chaperones. You know, John was with him at first, and then John went back to Hungary, and then there was another guy keeping tabs on him that, you know, had no military experience, but at least he wasn't crazy, and so he was there to make sure, keep Vlad from doing too much murdering. But eventually a time came, it was like, okay, it's time for Vlad to take his throne back. And so with help from Stephen the Great, his cousin from Moldavia, they just sort of converged from opposite sides on Targoviste, with the princely court there, and unseated the guy that was there, and Vlad was again in charge. The Ottomans had been pushed back, and yeah, so that was his third time on the throne. And then everybody, you know, they kicked back, had a few beers, and like, all right, great, we're out of here. And then they just left, and so now Vlad is by himself, you know, with a drastically reduced military that, you know, weakened from years and years of just nonstop fighting from people from all sides. And yeah, the Hungarians went home. The Moldavians went home, except for Stephen the Great left behind some bodyguards to kind of help out. But they were extremely weakened. And the Ottomans were still the Ottomans. And Vlad only lasted a few months. And they came in and they killed him.
How did he die?
We aren't sure. That's one of the spots in the book where I have to say I have no idea. Here's what may have happened. There's a lot of theories. What happened for sure is that he was found mutilated and decapitated near a monastery that he went to frequently called Snagov, which is about 25 kilometers north of what is today's Bucharest. He spent a lot of time there. He kind of turned it into a strategic defensive, you know, he fortified the monastery, which was kind of odd. But yeah, so in addition to hiding out there and going there to, you know, beg forgiveness for all of his murdering, it was just kind of like a refuge for him. And that's where the Ottomans caught up with him. And yeah, they killed him and took his head. And so Mehmed the Conqueror finally got Vlad's head. He was extremely relieved. And presumably, so the head was probably on display for quite some time as a trophy back in Constantinople. But they're not sure what happened, if Vlad was killed by a guy that had pulled a Dracula and snuck into the Wallachian camp disguised as a Wallachian soldier and killed Vlad. But I go off on my own theories here. How does a guy, you know, after he's done the very messy job of decapitating a guy, get out of there with the head of their leader, presumably covered in blood, and not, you know, somehow get some pushback from the people standing around? There's another theory that he got killed by friendly fire just at the end of another battle that they were going to win, but he got killed by friendly fire. And then, the other one is that, you know, he just died in battle. But we don't know.
And when we talk about friendly fire, it would have been what during this period?
Well, it was, I think it was an arrow is what they,
how
they describe it. But, I think, Vlad was in the habit of disguising himself as a Turk, and, you know, he spoke Turkish, and it might've been easy for one of his guys to mistake him for an enemy combatant and shoot him in the back with an arrow. But we don't know that that's the case.
As an expert in all things Romania and the go-to person for many years on Romania for the Lonely Planet travel guide, where do you suggest anyone listening who wants to go on a Dracula tour, where do you suggest they go? What are the best sites?
So there's plenty of spots to choose from. Some of them are extremely popular and some of them not so popular and kind of hard to get to. The most popular is probably Bran Castle, which is incorrectly called Dracula's castle because that was not his castle. They're not even 100% sure that he was ever inside that castle, but it was standing during Dracula's time, and he almost certainly was around it and went past it. During his house cleaning, he did have to go up into Transylvania to kill some guys and in Brasov, which is, Bran Castle is just outside of Brasov. So he'd got at least galloped past Bran Castle, and there's a theory that he might have either spent the night there or been in prison there. No one's not really sure for a short time, but that was not his castle. But it is beautiful. It looks like a vampire lives there, to this day. And it's a very popular tourist destination and easy to get to in southern Transylvania. So like 500,000 people go there each year, and it is super cool. It's gone through a lot of renovations and expansions, and it looks like a vampire lair. It grows out of the top of this rocky formation. It kind of looks like it's organically turned from mountain into castle, like some dark wizard had just made it pop up out of the mountain. It's very harmoniously built into the mountain there. And back in the early 20th century, the very brief reign of Romanian royalty, they fixed it up. They got some Western European furniture in there, but it's still open as a tourist site. Let's see, the next most popular place, I guess it kind of drops off there. I mean, Vlad spent some time in Brasov, but he was usually only up in there to kill some guys. So, while Brasov is associated with him, there's no like monuments to him because every time they heard that he was coming, that was bad news. The next most popular place was Sigishwara, which is where Vlad was born. And he lived there until age 3, and the home that he was born in and lived in until age 3 is still standing. It's a restaurant. And Sigishwara, even on its own, is a fantastic. It's like a walled city, citadel type situation. It's been very well renovated and cleaned up. It was kind of falling into disrepair, and it didn't get much love during the communist era, but it's all fixed up and looks very fairy tale like now, and it's a very popular place. And it's well known for many other things, but also Vlad lived there from age 0 to age 3. The less popular sites, but more important to Vlad himself, are the real Dracula's castle, which is called Poinar Citadel, and that is located in the hills on the border between Transylvania and Wallachia. It's not easy to get to. It's on a not very well paved road that is, has a mountain on one side and some not very great, driving to get it to the other side. So it's hard to get to. And then you have to climb more than 1,400 steps to get up there. There's like no escalator or anything, So I think just the physical, the demanding, just the walk up there kind of discourages a lot of people. It is not, you would think it would be, because Vlad is considered a national hero in Romania to this day, you'd think it would be overrun with tourists, but it's not, because A, it's hard to get to unless you rent a car and you really, really want to get there. And B, you have to be prepared to climb those 1,400 steps, or that's it. But when, it's not like huge. It hasn't been restored. It's ruins, but it's Dracula's castle. This is where he built this place as a defensive kind of a medieval safe room, and he hid out there, and he outlasted at least one siege there. That's a very important Dracula site that just doesn't get very many visitors. And the other place is Targoviște, the former princely court, the former capital of Wallachia. It's a small, not super important town now, but the princely court, the ruins of it are still there. Some of it's been restored to the best of their abilities. There's a tower. There's ruins of the palace itself and the grounds around it. There's a church and some outer houses, just support structures or just the foundations of these structures, because a lot of it is, we're talking about stuff that's 500 years old. I'm amazed that any of it's still standing. But, the fact that some of it is still standing and recognizable is kind of a testament to how strong they built stuff back then, I can't imagine anything, any buildings or houses here in Minneapolis ever being, around in 500 years. There's no way.
So I have to ask you about this. The Dracula we know today is a black cape-wearing vampire, far different than the real-life man. Can you explain how that happened over time, how he transitioned from medieval warrior to a gothic vampire?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, Dracula, for all of his failings, is still considered a hero in Romania. He defended Wallachia and sort of a little bit Transylvania against the unbelievable, overwhelming forces of the Ottoman Empire. So in that corner of Europe, he's considered a hero. Everywhere else, he's considered a maniac. And that's mostly because after he died, I mean, he was a living legend while he was alive, but after he died, his legend grew, and then things, things sort of got exaggerated and warped, as they often do. The chroniclers tended to be people who weren't necessarily friends of Dracula, like German writers who, you know, Dracula was well known for tormenting German settlers in Transylvania and lining them up and impaling them. So when they wrote about Dracula, it was not in a very friendly tone. It was basically all fiction, just for shock and awe to sell, their little stories. But these little pamphlets, there was no fact checking. There was no one standing around going, that never happened. And even in this day and age, fiction gets spread around as facts. And if you say it often enough, people start to take it as fact. And so the same was true back then. Dracula was outside of Romania was after all this character assassination work by various writers far, far away, decades after he died, you know, writing these stories that weren't remotely true. So that's how he got known as this vicious, crazy, bloodthirsty person. And one of the stories was that he liked to dip his bread in human blood. And so many centuries later, Bram Stoker is doing research for his vampire book, and he came upon a very old, I guess it was like a journal or a report from an ambassador or, dignitary that from England that was in Romania and had written about Dracula and his exploits. And this is where Bram Stoker not only discovered his name and decided to sort of misinterpret it as the devil instead of Son of the Dragon, but also undoubtedly this is where Bram Stoker learned of this story about Vlad, you know, dipping his bread in blood and he ate human parts and, you know, none of this stuff that actually ever happened. You know, he wasn't a cannibal. He was crazy, but he wasn't a cannibal. And so, you know, inspired by all this and, you know, there was already some vampire lore that had, you know, was well known and it's this sort of like crossed over and was conveniently, you know, cooperative with all that. And so he decided to name his antagonist Dracula after this. You know, he had a famous bloodthirsty lunatic real life person to base this on. And that was just a convenient little backstory. It's like, okay, so the real Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, never really died. He just drank enough blood over the centuries to sustain himself. And now he comes to light again when he's rediscovered in Transylvania, when he decides to take a little trip over to jolly old England and start sucking blood there for a little variety. So yes, it was all very convenient. And that's the easy and convenient story. But now there has been many books and theories in the years since that Bram Stoker may not have been as well read into Dracula as everyone thought. I mean, he undoubtedly knew of his existence, but there's a lot of material and proof out there that Bram based his character more on just the existing vampire canon, and the physical description of the vampire Dracula kind of fits the physical description of an actor, Henry Irving, that Bram Stoker had been working with for a while. He was tall and gaunt and, you know, just kind of a little sinister looking. And that's kind of like how Dracula looked. But also that's kind of how all the vampires at the time were described in fiction. Vampire fiction had started long before Bram wrote his book, and so he had a lot of like existing canon to work from, and so it's thought that maybe he just pulled from that rather than the legend of Vlad the Impaler.
Interesting. And Hollywood really changed it drastically from Stoker's original version.
Well, yeah, for the time, Dracula was the novel was extremely scary and unnerving, but we all sort of kind of, it takes more to shock people over the decades. And I think every time Dracula was reinvented or put out in a different form, it started as the novel, and then it became a touring live production, you know, theater production. And then Hollywood got a hold of it and then made a movie out of it. And each time they kind of gave him, added a few character traits to make him a little bit more scary, just because the original Dracula wasn't quite scary enough, and they wanted to make sure that people were terrified. And so by the time the movie came out, there was not only powers and a backstory that didn't line up with the novel, but had nothing to do with Vlad the Impaler anymore. They had gone way off even the fiction of Vlad the Impaler, but nonetheless, he was still called Dracula, and there was that association.
I'd love to see an accurate movie about Vlad the Impaler. That story is far more interesting to me, honestly.
I know. Right. Well, and I think that, you know, I mentioned this in the book kind of offhanded, but it's probably true that just from reading the novel and then also reading about the real Vlad the Impaler, it's pretty clear that Vlad the Impaler was not only a lot more interesting, but he also killed way more guys than Dracula the Vampire. I mean, this guy was he was a character. I think a real life movie about him. It couldn't even be a movie. There's just too much. It would be a fantastic, at least a miniseries. And I know there is a Dracula series that's in the works. So, and again, this is going to be Dracula the Vampire, not necessarily Vlad the Impaler, but hopefully some of that Vlad the Impaler backstory will make it into that and be somewhat accurate. But no, I'm with you. I'd love to see, as best as we know, an accurate representation of the life of Vlad Dracula. Just, you know, don't eat any big meals right before going to see it.
Right.
Because it will be disgusting.
Well, your account of how Vlad impaled his enemies is far more terrifying to me than a fictional blood-sucking monster.
Yeah, comparatively, that's a pretty chill way to go, right? Just have your blood drained from a gentlemanly vampire rather than being cut in half and then, you know, impaled or whatever, and then left to die slowly over 48 hours. I mean, it doesn't even compare.
No, it doesn't. So you have a website and a podcast, right? Tell us about those.
So I do have a website where you can find all this stuff. It is my very difficult to spell name.com. So I'll spell it LeifPettersen.com, LeifPettersen.com. That's where you can find details about Backpacking with Dracula and my most recent book, Throwing Up, Notes from 35 Years of Juggling. I've been a juggler since I was a little kid and decided to do a juggling memoir. But also just some, you know, my resume basically and some clippings and stuff like that. But I also, even though I'm not doing much in the travel media and marketing sphere anymore, I still do co-host a podcast on that topic. It's called Passport Travel Marketing and PR Podcast. And we talk about topics related to like destination marketing. It's a lot of tourism inside ball. Probably wouldn't appeal to people that don't have some sort of marketing or PR role in regards to destination marketing. But I do co-host that. And yeah, you know, I've been a pretty busy world traveler ever since my late teens. And, you know, that's going on 30 years. And that's where you learn most of it about me. LeifPettersen.com. I also have an old blog that I've just started to resurrect. It's called KillingBatteries.com. I'm also found by my name on Twitter, LeifPettersen, and also on Instagram, but it's the other way because someone stole LeifPettersen. So on Instagram, I'm PettersenLeif. Because some guy registered LeifPettersen and then posted one photo and never went back again, but I still couldn't get the name. So I'm PettersenLeif on Instagram. And if you want to buy the book, it's on Amazon. And also, if you happen to be in Minneapolis, lots of local bookstores have it here too. But the easiest way probably for most of you to get it is on Amazon. Just give a search for Backpacking with Dracula if you don't want to try to remember how to spell my name.
Right. Well, perfect. Thanks again and happy Halloween.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Again, I've been speaking to Leif Pettersen, author of Backpacking with Dracula, On the Trail of Vlad the Impaler Dracula and the Vampire He Inspired. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting from every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis,
and have a safe tomorrow.